From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. Today, after a dizzying 3 days, what's next for Michigan's historic same-sex marriage case?
There is this question still about everyone, every same-sex couple that got married on Saturday, this past Saturday, and that is, what is their status?
Then, is it too soon to expand the state's controversial education achievement authority?
There's a lot of declining enrollment. There's a lot of teacher turnover in the EAA districts in Detroit. And the test scores that came back are not great.
Plus, we get an inside look at how college party culture hurts social mobility.
There was not one cross-class roommate relationship that even survived the year.
We'll have those stories and much, much more on Stateside. More students in Michigan could soon be going to school year-round. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. There's bipartisan support in Lansing to try year-round schooling, but what does the data say? Does going to school all year long actually help students from losing skills over the summer? What does it mean to the normal school calendar, and what do teachers think about it? We'll ask those questions on today's show. And then college inequality, but we're not talking about the high costs of tuition or books and food. No, no, no. We're talking about inequality for women who choose to party rather than study. There's interesting new information that says low-income female students suffer more from the party scene than their peers with more money. But first, to history-making news in our state this weekend.
By the authority vested in me by the great state of Michigan, I now pronounce you married.
That was Ingham County Clerk Barb Byram performing Michigan's first legal same-sex wedding early Saturday morning. More than 300 gay and lesbian couples were married on Saturday, but now they're watching to see what a federal appeals court might do this week. That's because after Friday's decision that the state's same-sex marriage ban was unconstitutional, the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals called a halt to any more weddings. Lawyers challenging the Michigan marriage amendment have until noon tomorrow to file their arguments on why a stay should be lifted by the appeals court. Jean Durkowski got married to her partner on Saturday. She says no matter what happens, the fact that they have a marriage certificate in hand matters.
They're certainly going to put it in limbo, but no, they can't take that away.
Well, Rick Pluta has been extensively covering the gay marriage trial, everything that happened this weekend. He is, of course, the Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network and my co-host of It's Just Politics. Hi, Rick.
Hello, Zoe.
So what a weekend. Bring us up to date.
What a weekend.
Where do things stand right now?
Well, basically, everything right now is on hold since the Sixth Circuit issued its stay. The attorneys who are fighting the same-sex marriage ban have until noon tomorrow, as you pointed out, to file their case on why that stay should be lifted and marriages should be allowed to continue. But there is this question still about everyone, every same-sex couple that got married on Saturday, this past Saturday, and that is, what is their status? Are they married? Are they not married? Are they just not married yet, and they may even well be, well, kind of married in the eyes of the law?
Okay, and what are we hearing? Let's begin with Governor Snyder.
Well, what Governor Snyder is saying, what his office is saying, his spokespeople, is that because the situation is still confusing and that there is a stay, that he is just going to wait before making a decision on whether or not to recognize those marriages that were performed over the weekend, which means, as a practical matter, that for the moment, the state is not recognizing those marriages. And so if, for example, those couples wanted to start proceedings to adopt children, they're going to have to wait.
Okay, the folks who say, hey, we want to keep marrying people who believe that the state's ban on gay marriage is unconstitutional, what are we hearing from them?
Well, certainly they are going to ask the Sixth Circuit tomorrow to lift the stay and allow the marriages to continue. And just this morning, Ingham County Clerk Barb Byram and East Lansing Mayor Nathan Triplett, they asked the U.S. Justice Department, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, to recognize the marriages performed over the weekend. So that would at least confer federal rights on those couples. And that's what happened, for example, in Utah when marriages were suspended there by the courts, that the Justice Department stepped in and said, but we're going to recognize the couples that have already been married. And so that'll allow them to say, well, for example, they could now if Eric Holder recognizes them, they can jointly file their federal tax returns if they want to do that.
How likely is it that we'll hear from Eric Holder?
Well, that is what Eric Holder did in the case of Utah when they had sort of a similar situation, that there was a window where marriages were performed. And the Justice Department has said that they're looking at the situation and they're taking the request into consideration. And there is something else, that we do actually have same-sex couples living in Michigan whose marriages are recognized by the federal government because they were married in states that allow same-sex marriages, and Uncle Sam recognizes those marriages regardless of where the couple actually lives.
Sure. In fact, we just saw a ruling in Kentucky, for example, that state must recognize marriages, same-sex marriages that happened out of state.
Right. That was a federal court decision that's also being appealed.
So, Rick, let's turn our attention to the election, actually, that's now about 8 months away. And this interesting fact today that Bill Schuette is in the headlines appealing this decision, but also today is formally launching his campaign for re-election as attorney general. Coincidence? How did this all happen?
I think it was something of a coincidence, although if they had wanted to change their schedule, last week when they knew this was coming down, they certainly could have. And why not? In for a penny, in for a pound, that his name is in the headlines anyway. So, why not tour the state and let people know officially that you're running again?
But isn't there this idea that people are just going to be talking about the gay marriage ban when what he wants to talk about is, say, his campaign slogan, A Voice for Victims? I mean, he really is out front. People have put the spotlight on him sort of being the one, the person in the state who's saying, no, stop these gay marriages from happening.
Sure. And he is trying to talk about a whole host of things besides the same-sex marriage case, but it's just the 900-pound gorilla that you can't not look at it, you can't not talk about it. And, he's doing this, at the same time that, the newspapers and the internet are filled with, these really emotionally engaging pictures of people who got married over the weekend. And, we know that public opinion seems to be turning in the direction of more and more people supporting same-sex marriage. But, he's staked out his position on this. And I guess I just don't see what political benefit he would derive at this juncture from changing course on that.
Well, let's talk about changing course in the context of Governor Rick Snyder also running for re-election. You and I have talked in the past about just how official he is against same-sex marriage. Is that a real opinion he has? What is his opinion on same-sex marriage? How does this case, do you think, change that and change how he runs as a governor against same-sex marriage in the next 8 months?
This is something he does not want to talk about. He would like this election to be about the economy, about what he's done with taxes, about what he's done with Detroit. And he just can't avoid it that the governor said when he was running the first time that he, said that he's for civil unions. And then, but on the issue of same-sex marriage, he's sort of pronounced himself agnostic, said that it's not one of his priorities, that he's really a governor who's all about the economy and not these social questions, and would really just like to change the subject.
But will he be able to get away with that stance over the next 8 months? I mean, this seems like an issue now that is front and center. Is he going to be able to campaign until November by just saying, I'd rather not discuss same-sex marriage in Michigan?
Will he be able to get away with not talking about it? Probably not. But what he's going to hope is that, what people are actually making their decision on that it's not going to be based on these social issues, but on his handling of the economy or his perceived handling of the economy, mm-hmm. Especially if things continue to improve.
So, Rick, what should we be watching for before noon tomorrow when these briefs are meant to be filed?
Really, not a whole lot. Certainly you're going to see, particularly on the side of folks who are opposed to the ban on same-sex marriage, that they're going to be banging the drum, that they're going to say, do something to recognize, you know, these 300 people who got married, legally married,
right,
during that window over the weekend. But really, we're just waiting to see what happens sometime after, after noon tomorrow.
And then do we have any idea when we'll hear from the Sixth Circuit Court?
This temporary stay is supposed to expire Wednesday, and so we expect that they would act before then. But in terms of a final decision, that could play out over weeks or even months.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network and my co-host of It's Just Politics. Thanks for filling us in, Rick.
So glad to be here with you.
And a sure sign of spring is here, even if it is just in the 30s today. The annual release of kegs of Oberon beer is here. Bell's Brewery began offering the summer wheat ale today. Events are planned at bars around the state to celebrate. Still to come, the State House has given the okay for the Education Achievement Authority, that really controversial system set up for the state's most struggling schools, to expand. There were passionate speeches against the EAA on the chamber floor, but a majority of Republicans and one Democrat gave the go-ahead for the system to grow. Interestingly enough, though, it won't grow until after Election Day. We'll find out more in 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. When you think of inequality in higher education, things like tuition, maybe the price of books and food probably comes to mind. But what about inequality when it comes to the party scene in college? A new 5-year study found that if a young woman chooses the so-called party path rather than, you know, rigorous studying, and if she's from a working class or low-income family, that party path may not lead her to the great college experience or a promising career. The research was done by sociologist Elizabeth Armstrong of the University of Michigan and Laura Hamilton of the University of California, Merced. They've turned the research into a book, Paying for the Party: How College Maintains Inequality. Cynthia recently spoke with Elizabeth.
Elizabeth Armstrong, so good to have you on Stateside.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you and Laura had a dorm room at what you call a big Midwest University. You don't identify, but give us a thumbnail sketch of this Midwest University.
Well, there's schools that sometimes make the top lists for party schools. This was one of those schools, a school that in the last 10 years or so had hit it pretty close to the top of this list. This is a school with big time sports, a large, vibrant Greek system, and a school that where there's a certain set of students who select the school because of its social life. When they're going around looking at colleges with their parents, they're looking for fun.
Well, you started out with the idea of studying college student social life, meaning?
Well, we started interested in sex. Mm-hmm. We were interested in hooking up, relationships, sexual assault, drinking, and all of the kinds of kind of peer culture dynamics that kind of surround these activities.
And what made you shift your focus to social class?
Well, it was really being on the residence hall floor that led us to shift the focus. We still ended up writing a number of papers about sexuality, but when we got on the floor and we started to realize that women who didn't have much money were pretty much socially excluded from cliques and social groups on the floor. And so then we started really realizing that these social patterns had serious implications. Like one of the young women who lived across the floor from us, who was kind of lower middle class, very excluded. She said, well, you know, I have all of this time because I have no friends. No one will interact with me. So I should be able to do well in my classes. But I'm so depressed. I just can't bring myself to do anything. So
she didn't even get asked to be aboard the party train.
Oh, no. So the party pathway was exclusive. Mm-hmm. So some of the women from less economically advantaged backgrounds kind of tried to kind of get on board. Mm-hmm. And some of them kind of managed to participate a little bit. For example, we had some kind of working class girls on the floor who were very social and extroverted, who kind of made it into the kind of party clique on the floor. But when the kind of rich girls on the floor started getting into sororities and they didn't, then they were just really devastated because as they were kind of kicked out of the clique at that point and then kind of realized that the wealthy girls who were just kind of using them as kind of convenience friends until they made their real friends in the houses that they joined. And so they were pretty much kicked to the curb and ended up just basically rooming with each other in an apartment off campus the next year. I mean, they'd known each other before school. Mm. They came and they made these fake friends while in the dorm, made no real friends, and moved out and lived with each other the year after. And then eventually left the university, as did most of the less affluent women.
That's what I want to see. So take us out. You were kind of examining this group for a period of how long?
For 5 years. Mm. So we followed them from like the day they moved their stuff onto the dorm floor until after they should have graduated. Not all of them did, but we followed them. So the ones who left the university, we followed them as well. We followed them to the regional campuses that they moved to. We interviewed them back home when they moved back home with their parents after graduation. Laura followed them to the big city, the wealthy women to the big cities where they moved to. So she was able to see kind of their, you know, their families, their houses, their new apartments, their whole lives.
I'm speaking with University of Michigan sociologist Elizabeth Armstrong, along with her colleague Laura Hamilton, who's with the University of California, Merced. They actually had a room at a dormitory in what they call Midwestern University, a party university, very typical of what we find all across America. And they took a look at what impact the party path had on the girls who were attending. And as you found out, if the girls were from a lower class or lower working class or lower income family, it was a much tougher way to fit in than the girls from the more affluent. So did being on the party path slow down the kids from the more affluent families?
Not the wealthiest ones.
Okay.
Young women from upper class families. And by that we mean that they had fathers who were chief financial officers of major corporations, fathers who owned relatively large size businesses. Mm-hmm. These were families where the mom was out of the labor market, and basically they were had a very kind of traditional family structure, and basically money was not a relevant consideration. These young women, these were the ones whose parents basically understood that they were purchasing a social experience for their daughters. They came, they immediately joined sororities, they were interested in clothes, and they majored in a set of majors that we basically call easy majors or light majors.
For instance,
communications, tourism, apparel merchandising. Unfortunately, like all of the education majors ended up falling into this category as well. A lot of them were sort of some variety of kind of a business school light major. At this school, the admission to the business school was quite competitive. And so the women who ended up not being able to get in or not wanting to take exams on Friday and Saturday as the business school required, they took other sort of majors that sort of promised to be kind of similar to that, but that didn't have quite the same.
It's just a business school light.
Yeah.
So they tended to go in, I'm sure not all of them, but tended to go into easier majors. still could enjoy the party thing, which would include Greek life and all the sports and all the...
Yeah, and they went out a lot. So the women who were sort of the most, the socialites that we called them, mm-hmm. they went out 3-4 sometimes a week, sometimes even more often. The social life was where the kind of real work of college mm-hmm. happened, because that's where you would see and be seen, where you would accumulate status, where you're kind of where you fit into the whole sort of kind of hierarchy of the social scene was kind of worked out. So for the wealthiest women, they could do this the whole 4 years. But then after graduation, they did just fine because their parents paid rent on expensive kind of apartments in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles. Their parents or other family members had connections in kind of glamour industries, we call them, the sort of in sports, media, fashion, kind of advertising. And they'd often, their parents had often also worked with them to make sure they were doing really kind of high quality internships while they were in school. So while they weren't doing a lot academically in their classes, often during the summers, their parents were putting them up in New York or Chicago and basically funding them.
And they didn't have to work.
Unpaid internships. Yeah.
They didn't have to get the summer job to help pay for school the following fall.
No, they didn't need the summer job. Mm-hmm. There was pretty much no possible way to hold a job during the academic year, given these sort of demands of the social calendars that these women had.
So the more affluent girls seems like they got out of school on time.
They did. They all graduated on time, yeah. And they ended up either with decent jobs that their parents helped find for them, or it didn't actually really matter whether they were all employed right. or not.
So take us to the working class or lower income girls.
Yeah, there's really at least two different sets. So it's like, for example, the women most similar to the socialites who actually really participated heavily in the party scene but came from not quite as much wealth were the wannabes. Mm. So these were kind of middle class girls who had enough kind of wherewithal that they could kind of party hard while they were in college. But they, like one of them told us afterwards when she moved back in with her parents after graduation, nobody told me Disneyland was going to end. So she kind of thought that the kind of fast-paced social life of college would just continue. She hadn't had a very good discussion with her parents. Her parents were expecting her to graduate with actual skills that she could get a job. But she was partying with these women whose parents didn't have those expectations for them. And so there was a lot of kind of confusion. And this was quite common, that there was particularly for these kind of wannabe girls, that they were kind of looking to these very, very, very affluent women for kind of models of how to live in college. But their parents didn't quite understand, and they didn't quite understand that they weren't going to have the resources to continue this.
And then you found from the lower income family, the real working class family, most of them didn't get out in the 4 years?
No. The least affluent women, the women from working class families, and by that mean that their moms were doing child care mm-hmm. or their dad was maybe kind of an electrical lineman or mm-hmm. something like that, whose parents hadn't attended college themselves. These women were just blown away by this scene. Like this one of the roommate duos was a woman whose dad was the chief financial officer of a corporation. And her father was an electrical lineman. These women had nothing in common. They didn't even know why they didn't get along. They just didn't get along. And they were both lovely, really sweet, nice young women. The class chasm was just huge. There was not one cross-class roommate relationship that even survived the year. Mm. In all cases, the more affluent women moved out and found another roommate, and basically, or else the less affluent woman left campus before the end of the year even. So the working class women, they tended to leave the university once they really realized that the university was not set up to serve them well socially or academically. These were very, very resilient, they were the very, very highest achieving young women from their small, teeny little itty bitty rural towns. So they were quite resilient, able to overcome obstacles, bright. These were not like shrinking violets. These were people who were determined to get ahead. And so most of them, when they realized that this school was not set up to meet their needs, well, just said, okay, I'm out of here. And they transferred to regional schools where they found that there weren't the social distractions. The courses were actually better taught, smaller. They got more attention. They liked it. They could just drive their car and park and go to class all day and be done with it, and that other people around were just like them.
Do you think these findings might apply equally to male students?
Yes, we think that they probably do. We think that it's possible. It's a kind of unfortunate that we couldn't study men as as much depth.
Sure.
But we think that it's possible that men are even more sucked into the party pathway. Like at this particular university, there are more fraternities than there are sororities. And there's less of a cost for men in the sense that for women getting very highly involved in the social scene, there's reputational risks of being called a slut, mm-hmm. potentially, and there's risks of sexual assault. There's this edge to it, edge of kind of how do you navigate this world safely that isn't quite as much of a problem for the men. And so the men are kind of just like, in terms of encouraging men to rush, it's basically like, you're going to basically get to drink all the time and interact with all these really hot young women. Mm. What's not to like? Mm-hmm. And we know that young men now are achieving less academically. They're less likely to have good grades graduating from high school. They're less likely to make it to college to begin with. And they do less well when they're in college and graduate at lower rates. So it's possible that this is even more of a problem for them. I mean, it's certainly not, they're not exempt from it at all.
Elizabeth, what message do you think your research has for those working class families, the lower income and the working class families? Because right now, kids are either on college tours, the juniors are doing that this time of the year, and the seniors are, you know, looking for their acceptance letters. What message does it have as far as what questions they should be asking when choosing a college or a university?
Really pay attention to fit. Pay attention to whether this particular school is set up to serve this particular student. But I think another big factor in this is the issue of debt and what it's going to cost, because there's still, I think, among some Americans, this notion that a college degree is a college degree is a college degree, and no matter how much you have to go in debt in order to get it, that it will still pay off.
Right.
The research shows that yes, a college degree really matters, but it's which college degree from where. An engineering degree from MIT is going to have a different kind of economic payoff than a teaching credential from, you know,
or the generic communications degree.
Right, the communications degree from, you know, some sort of middle tier public. Mm. It just is. And so the amount of debt that's reasonable to incur depends on these things. And one of the things we thought about is that college is really a kind of an opportunity space. Mm-hmm. And it's a space where you have to basically take advantage of it, and it's not just in the classroom; it's with the extracurriculars.
Now, you've said one of your main concerns is that someone mm-hmm. reads your book and says, "See, higher ed in this country is horrible. We should stop funding it." So, what message do you want people and schools to take away from your book?
Yeah, well, I guess we talked a little bit about the parents, but in terms of the more general policy implication, if our kind of federal government and our state governments continue to fund higher education at low levels, this is going to make it increasingly a world that serves the socialites and sort of supports the party pathway, because the universities basically end up in a situation where they're trying to chase tuition revenue dollars and building climbing gyms and kind of creating this like massive social infrastructure. It's a way to get that money. Educating the students that are the mobility pathway students, the sort of less affluent students, mm-hmm. it's expensive. That's where you need really good advising. That's where you need to have great instructors. You need to have ratios of kind of student to faculty that are low. You need to actually put in the money to really actually do the work of educating. And if our society doesn't decide, doesn't really view educating people as a public good, that we're building citizens that are going to contribute generally to our society, and doesn't make it possible for us to do that, then it will be a consumption product for the rich.
And college will maintain the inequality.
Yeah.
Sociologist Elizabeth Armstrong is with the University of Michigan, and along with Laura Hamilton of the University of California, Merced, she's co-author of Paying for the Party, How College Maintains Inequality. A lot to think about. Thank you so much for joining us on Stateside.
Thank you for having me here.
This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. The State House has approved a measure to expand the controversial Education Achievement Authority. The EAA is the agency that's supposed to turn around some of the state's most struggling school districts. A final version of the bill could be voted on as early as this week by the state Senate and then sent to Governor Snyder for his signature. The legislation passed the House last week by just one more vote than was needed. Critics of the EAA, mostly Democrats, say student test results don't support putting more schools into the authority. Supporters, mainly Republicans, say the legislation allows for more tools to be used to turn around failing schools. Kathy Gray, Lansing reporter for the Detroit Free Press, has been covering the EAA in the State House and Senate. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Zoe.
So let's begin in the State House. A really, really close vote passed by just one more vote that was needed. That really kind of tells you just how controversial this legislation is.
Oh, absolutely. It was a highly emotional debate before the vote. And, it took the House quite a long time to reach a compromise that enough Republicans were willing to sign on to it. Five voted no. One Democrat and one independent voted yes on it. There was lots of wrangling going on beforehand to get to a point where they could get the 56 votes that they needed.
Yeah, and let's talk about that wrangling. So what was in the final bill? What will this legislation do?
Well, it will allow 50 more schools to go into the Education Achievement Authority, but it won't start until the 2015-16 school year, which conveniently happens after the election of this year.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. And I think that was one of the things that got a few Republicans on board. They certainly don't want to face the prospect of one of their schools going into the EAA just a month or two before the election.
Sure. And now another issue is that it would let ISDs take over schools first, right?
Yes, and I think that was a big sticking point for a lot of people. Instead of having, that big state bureaucracy taking over your little local school district, they've got the ISD, which your school district is perhaps more familiar with,
right,
which your parents might be more familiar with. And I think that was a sticking point that a lot of Republicans who had been reluctant to go along with this needed in order to vote for it.
Mm-hmm. Now, those opposed to the EAA continue to talk about test scores, the high teacher turnover rate, that students and parents are leaving the authority, but those arguments didn't seem to work.
Well, not enough.
Right, right, exactly.
And there's a lot of declining enrollment. There's a lot of teacher turnover in the EAA districts in Detroit. And the test scores that came back are not great. Also, the big sticking point for a lot of the Democrats was, we have not seen that this is a good experiment yet. This is only 2 years old, and we're not getting good numbers back. So we really need to give this, if we're going to stick with it, we need to give it more time. That's just an argument that wasn't persuasive enough.
Right. Now, we should mention that earlier this year, the state school superintendent, Mike Flanagan, sent a letter to the EAA saying he was ending the exclusive relationship with the authority. How do you think that played into this debate?
Well, I think that there were people out there who thought that Flanagan, Mike Flanagan, the superintendent of schools, was kind of taking matters into his own hand without a whole lot of guidance.
Mm.
And I think that the legislature wanted to kind of get ahead of that and get their own imprint on the EAA instead of having just Superintendent Flanagan out there kind of making decisions on his own.
Right. So passed in the House by a very small margin. Now it moves to the Senate, possibly even as early as this week. What are we looking to happen in that chamber?
You know what? I don't think that the House would have brought this up unless they had mm-hmm. some assurances that it was going to be taken up and passed in the Senate. Mm-hmm. The Senate has got a much larger Republican majority. It's 26-12 with 26 Republicans, 12 Democrats. And the Democrats are going to be united in their opposition to this. But they only need, you know, they only need to have 20 votes to get this passed through. And it's something that Governor Snyder wants very badly. And if it gets even closer, they can have Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly come in and cast a tie-breaking vote. So I don't think that it's going to be much of a problem in the Senate.
Are we likely to see some of the same sort of political wheeling and dealing in the Senate that we did in the House? Sort of a, you know, you can have this and this for this kind of vote kind of thing that we possibly might have seen in the other chamber?
You know, this thing has been floating around for a long time. And I think that there is a desire to dispatch with this pretty quickly. So, you know, I'm sure that the Democrats will try to get lots of amendments put through on this. None of them will pass. And I think that it will go through pretty unscathed just so they can get this off their plate before the spring break, which begins at the end of this week.
Right. And that's sort of so that's why there's this deadline to get it done this week, send it to Governor Snyder, who, as we mentioned, is behind this, has been pushing for the EAA. So lawmakers want it out of the way, but it's likely to affect at least somehow the election when the governor is up for reelection, most likely running against Mark Schauer. How do you see this playing into the gubernatorial campaign?
Well, it's going to be an issue that Democrats are pushing hard. They're going to be saying that Governor Snyder is pushing a failed experiment because the numbers just haven't supported the issue as it is right now. And it's certainly going to be an issue that continues to come up again and again and again in the gubernatorial campaign. The way it won't come up is there won't be additional schools put into it before the election.
Mm-hmm.
So there won't be, you know, a district in Saginaw,
right,
or a district in Flint or something that all of a sudden, who wasn't really going to be voting for Governor Snyder anyway, saying, oh, my gosh, my school is going into the state is taking over my school. And that's not going to happen before 2015.
So, Kathy, what are you watching for then in the next couple days? When will we know that a vote is coming?
I think that we'll know something tomorrow.
Okay.
When agendas start to come out and on whether the Senate is actually going to take it up this week. I think that they probably will, but the Senate and the House don't always play well together. So there's, you know, things are constantly changing up here in Lansing. So.
Yeah, we will wait and see. We will be in touch with you once a vote is scheduled. And, of course, updates with when it passes, if it passes, and if and when Governor Snyder signs it.
Right.
Kathy Gray, Lansing reporter for the Detroit Free Press, has been covering the Education Achievement Authority. Kathy, thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks, Zoe.
Some at-risk schools in Michigan could soon get more state funding if they agree to go year-round. In his budget address in February, Governor Snyder called for a state pilot program to encourage year-round schooling in Michigan. School districts could get money to add air conditioning and other upgrades to old buildings so they could operate during the summer. Supporters of the measure say students lose a lot of what they learn during the school year after long breaks. But do these measures actually work, keeping kids in school all year long? Harris Cooper is professor and chair of the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience at Duke University, and he has been going over the data. Hello, Harris.
Hello.
So Michigan is among the states thinking about more year-round schooling. What have you found in terms of year-round schooling effectiveness?
Well, what we did was we looked at the reports of school districts that had compared students who went to school on a year-round calendar with students who went to school on their traditional calendar. And there were about roughly three dozen of those. And when you put them all together, what we discovered was that certainly the year-round calendar has no negative effect on students' achievement. And for students who are poor, maybe struggling in school for different kinds of reasons, there was actually a noticeable positive effect.
And does this have to go to this sort of idea that children who come from families where there is money to, say, pay for summer schooling or tutoring or things like that, and maybe at-risk kids don't have that kind of money during the summer?
That's part of the explanation that people will give. We also find that if you speak with educators, and there isn't a great deal of numbers evidence on this, but anecdotally and experience of teachers and other educators, that especially for kids who have learning disabilities, they may lose more over summer. The different calendar has a more positive effect for them. Also for children who don't speak English at home, where the long summer break may lead them to forget the language of instruction, so that when they come back to school, especially in the youngest grades, as you can imagine, mm-hmm. when they come back to school, they not only have to relearn and remember the material, but they have to refamiliarize themselves with the language of instruction.
And is that something that you found through your research, this so-called summer slide, I think is sometimes what it's called, that sometimes it can take weeks and weeks for students just to relearn what they learned the year before and then sort of forgot over the summer?
Yes, a summer slide is real. It's especially true in math, and all children, whether they're poor or middle class, are susceptible to losing math knowledge over summer. When it comes to reading, there is a difference, though, where middle-class kids tend to hold their own, but poorer children tend to lose some of their reading skills over summer as well.
And is this a new phenomenon, or is this something that we've seen? Do we know? I mean, you know, does this have to do with maybe more screen time, as people call it, less outdoors time? Is this something that we saw, say, in the 50s and 60s, or is this relatively new?
Going back to the 50s is a little bit before you'll find any research on this, but okay. We certainly can say that it's been true for the last 30 years or so. I think the studies that we looked at were conducted over the last 30 years. And obviously for those, the availability of the video games and Facebook, et cetera, was not always there. So we can't blame this one on the new media.
Right. Why do you think there is this trend? And is there a trend towards looking at year-round schools? Is there something right now in our culture, the way people think about education, that's sort of pushing this to the forefront of new educational ideas?
There's a couple of things. One deals with the outmodedness of the school calendar that we use now. It was developed at a time when most people in the United States worked in agriculture. So there had to be some accommodation for children who were needed on the family farm. And the calendar that we have now really is a compromise between rural communities and urban communities about how to send kids to school. About 100 years ago, if we looked at school calendars, we would find that it wasn't unusual for kids in urban areas to go to school for a very long time, maybe even 10 or 11 months. And in rural communities, it wouldn't be surprising to find calendars where kids got off in May or June, went back to school, and then got off in August and September, mm-hmm. so they could help with planting and harvesting. The calendar we have now is a compromise, and it really, the long summer break, other than for traditional reasons, the long summer break doesn't really fit with the way most Americans live.
Right. And we should be clear, at least here in Michigan, when we talk about year-round schooling, really what we're talking about is not any more days or hours necessarily in school, but sort of moving breaks throughout the year, right? So it's not that you're looking at sort of an apples to oranges comparison that kids were in school more and thus doing better.
That's correct. In fact, all of the studies that we looked at held constant the number of days, about 180, that kids were in school, whether it was with a traditional calendar or with a year-round calendar. And people who are advocates of year-round education sort of cringe at the term because it gives a sense that your kid is going to be in school all the time and you'll have to come to the schoolyard gate and pass them their peanut butter and jelly sandwich through the gate because you're never going to see them. In fact, the number of days in the calendar are the same. At the moment, we have a summer break that lasts 10 to 12 weeks. And what the year-round calendars do, we use the term modified school calendar to get around that confusion. What it does is it puts kids either into 9 weeks on and 3 weeks off, repeated four times. Sometimes it's 60 days or 12 weeks on and 4 weeks off. But what it does is it breaks up the long summer vacation into multiple shorter vacations.
Now, what about negatives? I mean, what we're seeing here in Michigan is a pretty bipartisan effort to put money into these sort of pilot programs. But are there consequences, maybe any cons to year-round schooling that we haven't quite thought about?
Well, one concern, obviously, is the traditional use of the summer for families to be together for summer camp, especially because the weather is nice to make sure kids get outdoor activities, learn skills that you don't typically learn in school. That's a big part of it. A big part of it is tradition. There's also skepticism about what the true impact of it is. There are concerns about cost, how much extra cost there might be. Like, for example, you said Michigan is thinking about air conditioning buildings and how much that might require for capital improvements. So those are the big issues that the opponents will bring up.
So in the last 90 seconds or so that we have, when you look at this idea of year-round schooling, let's look 10, 20 years in the future, do you think that this trend will sort of become the majority? I mean, do you see more and more school districts across the country moving towards year-round schooling?
I think that more schools are going to look at it. There are quite a few who do already. And many of them do for economic reasons because they do need to keep the buildings open and schedule their kids in and out of vacations at different times. If we don't continue to invest in the infrastructure of education, that's going to be a force for changing the calendar. But the largest force is the way our calendar and our school day are really out of whack with the way most Americans live today. And eventually that's going to catch up with folks, and they're sort of going to say, why do we all have to go on vacation at the same time when both parents work outside the home? Vacation time for parents is more flexible, and maybe we'll get a better deal and less of crowds in Disneyland and Universal Studios if we can go in October and November instead of everybody being there in July.
Well, that's reason those enough kinds then, of, right?
That would be it. That's a big deal. And, you know, you think about fall vacations in New England. So all those things open up. But I think the key to the future is people looking at the way they live today and whether or not the current school calendar fits their needs and what's best for their kids. And I think the future will then suggest that modifications to both the calendar and the day are on the horizon.
Interesting. Harris Cooper is professor and chair of the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience at Duke University. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Stateside was produced today by Mercedes Mejia and Allie Billings. Stateside was engineered today by Tony Brown. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.